7. And then we can go to things like antacids, which have a pH of about 8, all the way up to things like drain cleaners. So drain cleaners have a pH of about 14.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
We return to Dr. Bruce Gibb, explaining exactly how our emissions turn the ocean more acid.
So we've got this range of acidities from highly acidic 0 to 14, and everything exists in between those two extremes. Why do we have to be thinking about this? We have to be thinking about this because when CO2 in the atmosphere reacts with water, it forms a weak acid called carbonic acid. So we combine one CO2 molecule with one H2O molecule, and that makes carbonic acid. The two protons on that carbonic acid, those two H atoms, they are acidic, and carbonic acid wants to donate them to things. That means that rainwater is actually slightly acidic. It's about a pH 5.6. So you know, we don't dissolve, that's not a high pH, but it is a pH. It says there's a surplus of these protons or hydrogen atoms in the raindrop. In contrast, if you go to the ocean, then we find that the pH of the ocean is about 8.1. It is slightly basic. It's beyond pH 7. And that is because the ocean, as we all know, when we swallowed a mouthful of it, is filled with a variety of salts. And those variety of salts, en masse, tend to accept protons rather than donate protons. So they're bases rather than acids. And that pH value is above 7, it's pH of about 8. So when we actually dissolve CO2 in water, whether it's in the atmosphere or whether you're making some carbonated water at home with a soda stream or an equivalent device in your kitchen, we're actually doing a small chemical reaction. It's not just a matter of doing sodium chloride with salt. When you add salt to water, you're simply dissolving it. But with carbon dioxide, you're dissolving it and it's undergoing a reaction. And so what you end up with, carbon dioxide in water actually makes 5 species. And that's where it gets a little bit more complicated than we maybe would want to, because that leads to all these different names, such as carbonates and bicarbonates, and, you know, that does cause some confusion. But what do we have when we add CO2 into water? We have some carbon dioxide that's just dissolved. We have water, of course. But again, we formed carbonic acid, and that carbonic acid is an acid. It wants to donate protons, and so it does. It donates protons or hydrogen ions, and in the process it forms what is called hydrogen carbonate or bicarbonate, and so that's baking soda, basically. That is a negatively charged species, and it's a weak base, so it can accept that proton again. You can go backwards if you wish, but let's not think about that. You can also lose the second proton, and that forms carbonate. And carbonate is an ion, which is part of calcium carbonate, which, of course, is chalk and limestone and all these other things I've mentioned. And we can form a variety of other salts. But in the ocean, en masse, there's more of these salts than there are of the carbonic acid that rains down on them from the sky. And so you literally have raindrops reacting with the carbonates in the ocean to have this very, very microscopically sized acid-base reaction, whereby you change the composition of the ocean just a little bit. Now, that's gone on since time immemorial. The problem is that we are releasing more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere by burning fossil fuels. And that larger amounts of carbon dioxide are raining down on the ocean, which again is slightly basic, and so it's being made more acidic by this acid falling into it. And that rate is increasing, of course, with the more CO2 we pump out, the more rain is acidic, the more the oceans are acidified. Now, when we're talking acidification, we're not talking about making anything like tomato juice or, you know, pH of 5. We're just talking about small incremental shifts. So again, the oceans are pH of 8.1. That pH is not fixed, and the ocean's a big place, and mixing occurs. And so it ranges from about pH 7.8 to about 8.2. But that number is coming down a little bit, just by 0.1 or 0.2 pH units so far. So maybe down to 7.8 or a little bit below, again, depending on which part of the ocean you're in. But that acidification does have ramifications for everything that utilizes all the carbonate in the water. That's a very long answer to a very...
No, actually, that was a very clear explanation, and I think I've appreciated that cycle better now than I grasped it before, so thank you for that. Does freshwater input from melting glaciers increase or reduce acidity, and does glacial input matter for the global acidification problems you raise?
The answer is no and yes. Did I get that the right way around? So when a glacier melts, you're adding considerable amounts of fresh water into the sea, and that does affect the net pH, and so it gets diluted, and so the acidity does decrease somewhat, so it counters all the CO2 that we're dissolving. The problem is a matter of scale. You know, 96%, 98%, I can't quite remember the number, of all water on Earth is salt water. And so the quantities that we're dealing with are relatively small, at least globally. Now, that's not to say you cannot affect a local environment. If you have a fjord where the currents in the ocean are relatively limited, then a glacier melting into that can dilute the salts in the ocean and therefore change the net pH. So locally, yes, potentially. You know, if there's a sudden melting of a glacier and a sudden change in the pH of the water, albeit a small one, that can be a shock to the local marine life that utilizes or relies on that pH being more or less constant. But globally, you know, it sort of washes out, for want of a better term.
Bruce, hopefully some listeners today will be alive in the year 2100. Assuming reducing emissions takes several decades, do we know how much more acidic the ocean could be?
The short answer is no. There are physical limits. So if you've ever used a soda stream or seen somebody operate a soda stream and you've heard that the machine burp at you when you've pumped in as much carbon dioxide as you can, that is literally because you have put in as much carbon dioxide as you can. So there is an absolute limit. Now, that absolute limit is somewhere around about pH 5 or 6. We will probably never get down to that level. We did. If we turned the oceans into something akin to tomato juice, then we would be, you know, in dire trouble. But there is this absorption process of these acids going on by the carbonate salt. Take a lot longer than, again, the rate we're putting it into the water. And so eventually it would compensate. So the term in chemistry we use is a buffer. And so a buffer is something that can handle changes, input of an acid or a base, without changing the net pH of this solution. And so those carbonates do react with the carbonic acid that gets added to the ocean, but slowly. I would say, overall, the rate by which we are adding carbon dioxide into the oceans is very fast, but not so fast that we would ever get down to that pH, that at some point the rate of neutralization of that acid would match the rate of, by which we're adding it. So, you know, the change in pH over the industrial revolution in the ocean has only been about 0.1 or 0.2 pH units. Sounds very small, but those are significant for reasons we can talk about. And so, you know, in theory, if you go down to, if you took all the ocean, all the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and put it into fresh water, the volume of the ocean, you would drop the pH substantially, maybe down to 6 or something like that, very quickly. But, you know, there are carbonates in the salt that buffer, that counter these effects. And so we'll never get down to pH at that level. If we do, we won't be around to talk about it.
Well, getting to what I think is a key question, can ocean absorption of carbon dioxide keep up with human emissions? And is that the saturation horizon in the title of your essay?
Carbonates in the ocean come in two forms. Calcium carbonate comes with aragonite or calcite. These are the two main forms of carbonate in the ocean. And they have unusual solubility properties. They actually get more soluble the colder things get. And so at the bottom of the oceans, they are fully dissolved. But at the top of the oceans, they're saturated. And so there is too much calcium carbonate to dissolve. And that's one of the reasons, or probably the prime reason, why Mother Nature utilizes carbonates to build phytoplankton shells and crustacean shells, because it's there. At a certain point, though, between this area where there's excess calcium carbonate and areas where it's fully dissolved, there is what is called the saturation horizon. And that's just simply the level by which you go from one state of affairs to the other. And marine biologists, and I'm not a marine biologist, but marine biologists and geochemists think of this saturation horizon because it's important for life. If you're above the saturation horizon, say somewhere near the surface, you've got energy from the sun and you've got this calcium carbonate that you can utilize to grow your exoskeleton or shell, and that's great. But if you go below the saturation horizon, then all of a sudden you're in a zone where the calcium carbonate will just start to dissolve because it's more soluble in the lower parts of the ocean. And so the saturation horizon is for many life forms a sort of cutoff zone. You don't want to go below this because you can't keep up building your crustacean shell, for example, at the rate that you're losing calcium carbonate because it's just more soluble. Now, most compounds, you know, table salt is more soluble at higher temperatures. Sugar is likewise. That's very normal. Calcium carbonate is rather unique, or at least rare, that it's more soluble at colder temperatures at the bottom of the ocean. So, yeah, the saturation horizon not only defines the level of the saturation horizon, not only defines a sort of crude differentiation between where life can thrive and where life has a little bit more difficulty, but it also tells us that that level changes according to pH. And so we can also get an understanding of not only the habitability of a particular part of the ocean or a particular depth of the ocean, but we get an idea of the chemistry, the concentrations of calcium carbonate by defining the saturation horizon and seeing how that changes from locale to locale or year to year.
You know, a lot of the studies and conversations tend to focus on threats to species living in the sea, but I wonder, as a chemist, do you see other reactions to acidifications developing, like changes in minerals, new chemical processes, or even alterations to currents or ocean mixing?
So that's a complicated question, or questions. So in terms of ocean currents and all that, the jury's still out. We don't really know how changes in pH are going to affect such things as ocean current. It's maybe not directly tied to pH, but when you're changing the speciation in water, again, you've got these at very simple level five things: water, carbon dioxide, carbonic acid, hydrogen carbonate, and then carbonate. Those have a, there's a speciation, relative percentages of each one, that changes as a function of temperature and pH, and so, and things like density also are affected. So, you know, changes in the pH may affect, will affect the speciation, which will affect the density of the solution, and that may affect currents. Those sorts of things, you know, we just haven't really explored yet. In terms of new processes, no, not really. The carbonate buffer, which is what the ocean basically is, the chemistry of that is fairly well described. That's not to say pH changes, small pH changes can't have huge effects. But in terms of brand new chemistry, no, that's not really a thing. But the simple fact is we just don't know for sure what's going to happen. We can maybe guess at the chemistry and know what's going on quite accurately. But the real hard part is understanding how life responds to that change in chemistry. You know, a crustacean might use a protein for sequestering the calcium carbonate in the ocean to help build its shell. And that protein may sequester at a certain rate. And we don't know what that rate may necessarily be. And so changes to the speciation in the water can affect that rate. And so, you know, some animals will likely thrive and others will suffer as a result of this change in acidity. So we can go back to, you know, if we go back quite a long time to, let's say, 56 odd million years ago, I believe, the Paleocene-Eocene thermal maximum. This was a period when the Earth warmed 6 to 8 degrees centigrade for about 200,000 years or so. And that was associated with a massive input of carbon into the oceans from the atmosphere. And that had, you know, significant consequences. There were mass extinctions of many of the small dinoflagellates and phytoplankton. There were changes to the morphology of these. There were undoubtedly species that thrived as well. And so, you know, that's an area of earth sciences I don't know anything about, but it is an active area of research, looking at the soil samples or mud core samples and looking to see how these populations of these small marine life forms changes and how they changed in response to periods of time, such as the Paleocene, Eocene. So we know that's going to happen. The slightly worrying thing about the burning of fossil fuels is that although the Paleocene-Eocene thermal maximum was a very rapid process, our addition of CO2 into the atmosphere is far more rapid than that. And so we really haven't probably seen yet the effects on life form populations, because that will take time to pan out. But by changing the pH of the ocean, you are favoring some species and disfavoring others. And the question is, what are the consequences of that? You know, that are phytoplankton's response are responsible for almost half the oxygen that we breathe. And so, you know, if you're affecting that population, or the, all those populations of phytoplankton in a negative way, then you lose half your oxygen. You know, I don't think the world will ever get that bad, but these things, these changes are occurring and will occur.
We are starting to run low on time, but I do want to ask Bruce Gibb, do you think we can fix this? Are there geoengineering ideas to control acidity in the ocean, and would that be a good idea?
You know, that's sort of getting slightly almost philosophical. You know, geoengineering, for me personally, is a sort of scary process. Again, it's a matter of scale. So, you know, if you look at some of the carbon dioxide scrubbers that have been built, the one in Iceland, whose name is escaping me, that runs on geothermal energy. You know, the amount of CO2 that these things can absorb, you know, this is a big plant that serves the whole country, and you would literally need a million of these in order to maintain this current CO2 level rather than, and more than that, if you were to actually decrease the amount of. It's a relatively benign technology, but it's whistling in the wind in many respects. I mean, the only true answer to avoiding this is simply to stop burning stuff and to limit our further future carbon dioxide emissions. You know, we blow in through the 1.5 degree limit set by the Paris Accords, by the looks of things. Preliminary data for the last 3 years, that average is slightly over 1.5. You know, if we get up to 4 degrees of warming, that's a lot of carbon dioxide, and that's correspondingly a big pH change in the ocean. And, you know, how all these things feed together, we're just barely starting to understand. So is geoengineering a good idea? If we're just removing CO2 in a benign way, then theory, yes. But the scale is just, you know, tremendous. There's no getting around the fact that as a species, we have burned a lot of hydrocarbons and created a lot of concrete. Readers may not appreciate this, but concrete is number 2 or 3 on the list of human emissions that are difficult to address. In theory, we can turn to renewables in the next 10 or 20 years fully, and that takes care of that. But, you know, there are other CO2 emissions than just burning fossil fuels. And so concrete, we're building in New York City every month for the next 40 years or something. That's how much concrete we're making. All that generates vast quantities of CO2. So the scale of the problem is just, unfortunately, really difficult to address. And, you know, as a chemist, you know, we can go into the lab and do an experiment. And if things go horribly wrong, then, you know, you lose a day's work and you come back the next day. That's not something, you know, as the old saying goes, there is no planet B. So I'm not a big fan of geoengineering in general terms, although there could be some specifics that are useful, such as just CO2 sequestration. But again, the scale is just almost impossible. You know, how do we address this problem? It's not something that I've seen us capable of doing. And, you know, I'd love to find some solutions, but I don't think they're there.
From Tulane University in New Orleans, we've been speaking with chemist Dr. Bruce Gibb. Find links to the paper and my notes at ecoshock.org. That's published every Wednesday. Bruce, thank you for sharing your time with our listeners.
Thank you, Alex. It's been a delight. Thank you very much.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Looking at weird waves of extreme record heat and cold circulating Earth this winter of 25-26, I was wondering, are we seeing something new? How would we know, with only the past as a guide and a system so variable as weather? There's a lot of strange weather in the Northern Hemisphere, including continental splits with rough cold winter blusters in the north and unusual near-summer weather in the south. We see that in North America and in Europe. Cold in Germany, sizzling in Crete, new January high record. Turkey and southwest Russia hot. But the real kicker was blaring dangerous heat in South Australia. The government was freaking out about fire risks so extreme it is off the charts. And indeed, some fires flared up. Our guest next week on growing wildfire risk around the world just told me temperatures around his home reached 45 degrees C. That is 113 degrees Fahrenheit. Crazy stuff happens to the environment when that happens. Unprotected people without AC will die. So will a lot of other species. Oh, and a tropical cyclone hit Queensland. It's hell weather in parts of Australia. We all hope this is not another black summer. Maybe our Aussie listeners and friends will get through this one this year. When global warming drives widespread change to the whole ecosystem, These are called bioclimatic extremes. That's a new phrase. You haven't heard it. It came out in a January 7th paper about bioclimatic extremes in the Arctic. And so that is where we are, friends. We have to invent new labels for climate-driven extremes previously unknown to current Earth systems. Sure, we're entering an era of bioclimatic extremes. Already on this planet, wildfires burn so intensely that forests are not coming back. Landscapes get washed away by record extreme rains in a day. The coral world nursery to a quarter of all sea life is dying and disappearing in hot, acidic seas. You may be insulated by the residue of carbon colonial wealth. You see, most of us did colonize the atmosphere. We spread our waste into the air and sea somewhere else for decades, over a century. Carbon-based history subsidizes most of us for food and our transportation system and all that. Most of us have that buffer against the first storms of climate change. Most of us will be okay. Others in Pakistan, Bangladesh, and the Pacific Islands are already going under that wave of heat, floods, drought, storms, and of course, just the acid sea. In a minimal economy, millions of people slide further into poverty until millions flee. Only a few in the West are getting burned out or storm-wrecked. We absorb the first punches, but nature is always the champion. The bioclimate always wins. For now, the pressing need is to decarbonize right now, fast, and adapt. That requires rebuilding community, and that's not easy. Eventually, if we fail to refocus politics into the demands of reality and common good, then this is, well, it's not yet, but comes the time for survival during possible blackout breakdown. Isolated TikTokers and screen minders do not know how to grow food or shelter during extremes, how to survive on small power like a solar panel and a battery, how to find firewood or drinkable water, how to work with insects and microbes without killing them all. It takes 7 years to train a doctor. Maybe it takes 7 years to rebuild a person capable of living in their actual environment as a cooperating part of it. It takes 7 years to construct a new economy and larger politics, not built on death. Prepare for a long struggle where the outcome is unknown. Thank you for listening and being part of this community that learns from science. Next week, we will not be talking about the latest outrage on the net. Instead, we face a demon already coming out of climate change, a new regime of wildfires. Please tune in next week for Radio EcoShock.
You are now listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC.
This is Bird Note. Male birds give it their all to get a female's attention during the breeding season. Some males sing, and some build intricate nests. But then, there's the magnificent frigate bird. Magnificent frigate birds are huge, gangly seabirds found around the warm waters of the southern U.S. and all the way down to Brazil. They often nest in large colonies, building nests out of sticks in the trees and shrubs. When it comes time to mate, the jet black males perch in groups of up to 30 at a time. Displaying side by side, each male inflates the skin of his bright red throat pouch, which swells into an immense elongated heart shape below his long, slender beak. Then the male rattles his bill, drumming it briskly against the huge red balloon of his pouch. The result is a crazy, jazzy mix of drums and clicks. As they drum, the males also wave their heads, quiver their wings, and screech a bit. And then they really step it up when a female glides overhead. When a suitably impressed female lands beside a male, the two will shake their heads in rhythm, clack their bills together, and intertwine their necks. A perfect ending. but just the start of raising a family. For BirdNote, I'm Mary McCann.